see you too. I am so excited today because you have a phenomenal setup at the moment. You know, I don't know who's available to join us live. If you're here, please say hi. We won't be able to get to see everybody from LinkedIn either because the count is not always there, but do say hi. So George and I met, I would say almost 5 years ago. And is that right, George? Yeah.
Maybe like, yeah, five and a half. Yeah, about 5-ish years ago. Yeah.
That's not right. 2016. I know, time really flies. I remember. Yeah. So basically a little bit about your background. I went to Harvard. I live in Boston for those of you who are unclear about that. So you were introduced to me through Alexander Bono International. Thank you, Barry and Cosmo. And I was able to go to Harvard and then go to your, what do you call that? Like a practice hall or like a recital room or something?
Yeah, it was like a little salon room. Yeah.
Yeah, you were. I remember you picked up the keys and then, you know, you took me into this room where you practice. It was such a meditative experience, something that I never took for granted. And remember going to see you perform. You were at the time a classical musician. And then since then, real quick, the 10,000 foot view is that at one point, you know, you were a working musician. At one point you moved back to California where you grew up. And we met up again 3 years ago during my documentary shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Venice Beach. It was so cool. And you were working on robotics. So you were an entrepreneur at the time. And fast forward a few years later, now you found your way back to music. And you even talk about how music is now the only way for you to share your story, where you find your peace, your happiness. So I'm just so glad you're here.
No, thank you for having me. And it's just so amazing as a friend and a fan to watch your podcast grow. Like, that's just kind of cool. And like, you know, you really were one of the early ones in the podcast world because it didn't really pick. I mean, podcasts were popular, but it's not like the way it is today. I mean, podcasts, like I listen to so many podcasts because, like, you know, being in LA, you drive a lot. Mm. And actually what I used to do was I would play movies on my iPhone. I wouldn't watch them. So don't worry, I'm not breaking any laws, but I would listen to the movies like an audio, like a podcast. But then when podcasts became like a thing and there was a show format and they're incredibly entertaining. And so that was just cool to see your podcast take off. That was super awesome. So yeah, it's amazing what's happened throughout time.
I know it really is amazing. I mean, to follow your journey to see, I mean, prior to this conversation, I think about all the pivots that you've made today, still as a very young musician. And it's just phenomenal to watch. And it's so fascinating. So I'm so thrilled that most of the people who follow me are creative entrepreneurs, content creators. And I don't see you as, you know, anything other than that, right? You create content. You're now on Spotify. You started your own journey on YouTube as well. And I'm just glad we reunited and really talk about our own journey in different ways, how you found your path. And I'm sure that's still evolving and changing. But I mean, you're sitting in front of a beautiful piano right now. And we're, for people who are joining us, say hi. We haven't figured out exactly how we're going to handle this, but we're just gonna go with the flow. And yeah, George, could you kind of explain maybe like how you transition your music? You know, when we talk about classical music, what did you used to play versus what you play now and how you make the kind of, you know, bridge the differences and all that?
Yeah, for sure. So I was like a super classically trained concert pianist. And I think like it was really hard to be at that level. And I was not a prodigy, so I had to work, and I was a really bad student when I was young. Like, I played an hour a week for a really long time, and it wasn't really until college I decided to really become a serious musician. Mm-hmm. And I dropped out of Harvard for a year and I studied piano and conducting, and like I just remember the early days I would just play like scales like this slow. I mean, like really boring stuff with the hand. And like, you know, it was just like, so then like, you know, I don't think I practiced 10,000 hours, but I got like, I think I have like a good 6,000 under my belt. And like, so then, and then after, when I started touring just classical, you know, I would play things like, you know. You know, like Beethoven or. Chopin or something, and like, you know, I did that for a bit, but I was always a very, I love collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I think I at heart was always a composer. I always wanted to say what I wanted to say, and I found that to be at odds with the classical music industry. Even though you're taught growing up to be an artist, you have to be yourself and mm-hmm. bring something unique to the table, especially in American piano pedagogy, like you're supposed to be as faithful to the score, but mm-hmm. no one was alive when these composers were alive. So it's all guess. It's like very educated guesses. Mm-hmm. But then your individuality gets robbed. And unless you're like super famous where people don't care what you do because they go to see a concert to see you, until you reach that level of fame, it's like, the amount of criticism you would get for taking risks was crazy. And in fact, from a mental health standpoint, incredibly negative. And I just became really bummed out by the industry. And mm-hmm. I wasn't having fun anymore. And so that's kind of why I stopped touring. Mm-hmm. I went into like design and tech. And how I fell back into music was, you know, partly from a breakup. So, you know, those drive musical inspiration a lot. But also this, I think like, I always loved music, but I've always wanted to improvise and compose. Mm-hmm. And it's a really hard skill to develop. And I was always jealous of jazz guys. They can just go like, like they can just do that like without thinking, or like that you'll hum a tune, like if you're like, oh, the Barney, you know, the Barney theme song, oh, like oh. Like, you know, and I was just like, oh man, I wish I could do that. And during the pandemic, kind of two things happened. One was emotionally distraught, and then the whole world, you know, was in lockdown. And so I feel like I was so emotionally and spiritually robbed mm-hmm. from my world, my brain, of like that part of your brain that with creativity, that which mm-hmm. you draw, like the energy you draw from to be creative was completely depleted and decimated. I was like, well, I have nothing to do. I didn't have a day job. I was living with my parents, and I was like, well, you know, at this point, what can I do that I really want to do? And I was like, I really want to be able to improvise. And I realized the only way to do that, like to do it like well and quickly, is to have an innate understanding of the instrument where whatever I think of in my head, I can play. The second thing was I have to be able to compose in my head and hear everything before I play. And so I would just, to practice, I would like sing a tune in my head and then try to see if I can play instantly on the piano. And there was a lot of trial and error there. Or I would like, when I'm dreaming, I would dream about playing the piano. And I started to notice that when I played piano in my dreams, I don't have perfect pitch, but it matched the keys in real life. Like if I'm in my dream, I'm playing like, it's actually the same note. It's like a Pixar movie. And so I was like, okay, I think there's a subconscious understanding. And then I would also like mental practice. Like I would take a score and just look at it. Mm-hmm. And I would practice pieces in my head, like imagining where the fingers would go and the pedaling. And I think that with a combination of I love playing guitar, and I like took this online guitar class from Brian Sinister, who's one of the guitar players and composers for Avenged Sevenfold, the metal band. And he talked about how to improvise on the guitar. And I kind of took all of that. And the one day I came to the piano and then I just started playing. Just like something clicked in my head, and this is like April of last year, and then I was like, shh, oh crap, I can improvise now. And then all of a sudden I can hear music in my head and just play it. And like when I write music now, I can just sit there and just like listen to it in my head and be like, okay, I'll write that. And like this has never happened to me my whole life.
And then it happened.
I know that was and then it happened. It literally just happened. Like, I can't explain. Just one day woke up now and I was like, I could play anything. Like there's a really difficult exercise in theory of doing a descending fifth sequence. It sounds like this. Rising fifth. That's a very difficult theory exercise in harmony, in Western classical harmony. But I don't know, after that thing clicked, I could just go like sometimes to practice, I just go like, do it from will. And I was just like, oh wow, this is insane. So yeah, that's how I transitioned. That was kind of like the transition process of going from just playing, you know, to like doing my own stuff. So yeah.
Okay, now you've set the bar really high. I would like future live stream guests to basically welcome themselves or me to the show this way. And it is very soothing. And I started listening to your new album, Peach Something. What was it again?
Peach Tree. Under the Peach Tree. Oh, I have the vinyl.
Oh, check it out, guys. What a treat. Whoa.
That's the vinyl. And then I collabed with this amazing artist, Maggie Cheung, Taiwanese American artist, to do the cover. And
wow.
And then the vinyl itself, like, it's kind of cool. Like, it has like part of the album cover on it.
Wow. So cool. Yeah. I mean, do people buy the vinyl, or is this like a collector's edition or something?
Yeah, I actually sold out. I should have made more. I only made like 18, I made 20 of them, and then I kept one and Maggie kept one. I didn't think I was going to sell a lot because this is such a departure from my past music career. Like, it was basically rebuilding my fan base, because my old fan base was like, you know, we want to hear. You know, like all the old classics. And then like this new, like the new, my new audience, I'm trying to convince them, you know, like stuff like this. That's a pretty drastic shift, you know, and I feel like so it's like rebuilding a whole new fan base. So I didn't think we were going to sell out. We sold out. I keep saying we. Well, yeah, technically it was me and Maggie, but we sold out in a day. We sold out all 18 copies. And then I realized I should have made 100. But you know, the process of an entrepreneur, you know, followed the lean startup model, or the IDEO human centered design process. You ideate, you prototype, you put it out in the world, you learn from it, and you keep learning. So I was like, okay, now next time I know, I'll make 100 vinyl.
There's so much to break down here, right? Like, I'm so glad people are going to be watching this now or later, because the cross disciplines of music and content creation, blogging, podcasting, YouTube, frankly, it's all the same. You know, I don't know why we separate the disciplines so much, but what, first of all, George, there's so much to break down. What you just said about pivoting from one subject, one topic to another, that's scary because you've already built an audience. You've been a working musician for a long time. Classical music is drastically different. And even within classical music, and there are different disciplines, different styles. And now you've sort of left your old audience as a concert pianist into this new genre. I mean, let me start with one question at a time. I mean, what did you see as the trends? Like, how did you know that? How did you know the metrics that people were leaving and new people were coming? And where did these new people come from?
That's a great question. In terms of my music, it is honestly what I like playing and how I think. And so some people like I've been playing a lot on Clubhouse or I've been playing a lot. I've just been doing a lot of stuff online. And someone asked me do you play this way because it's more trendy? And I said, I never thought about it that way. I was like, no, I play it this way because I like playing it. I like playing the piano this way. And I'm really proud to say as an artist, nothing I did in the transition process was to pander to an audience. It was, it was just me as an artist. I guess from an entrepreneurship standpoint, it was the most an entrepreneur thing to do. I did not listen to the market. I did not try to find product market fit. You know, if I was trying to find product market fit, I would be wearing anti social club. I would just have a ton of beats and I would not use an acoustic piano, but I wasn't thinking about an audience. So that's the first thing. The second thing, to your question is I noticed when I put it out there that I was not really playing classical anymore, I lost a lot of, I lost followers on Instagram. That was the first thing.
Yeah.
Lost followers on Facebook. I lost contacts in the industry. So gigs I used to get that were really easy started to disappear. And it was interesting because I look at my Spotify and Instagram data, and my demographic is strictly 25 to 35, a huge percentage of my audience, which is the audience classical music venues desperately need. And they were turning me down because I was not, they would ask me, are you going to play a Chopin scherzo, or are you going to play the third ballade or Schubert? And I was like, no. I'm gonna play a song I wrote. And I'm gonna do I love playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. They're like, oh, okay. Well, you know, if there's an opening, we'll let you know. And so those were kind of the immediate consequences. But I did notice with my new fans, and I'm not famous. So I know it's compared to a really well-known concert pianist, it's not a lot, but to me, I'm just super grateful for these fans. I've never had a fan experience where people have been helping me on their behalf. They're just I've had fans send me gifts, just out of the blue. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Or people I've never met before promote my album, or someone introduced me to a performance opportunity. I've never had this kind of love from the fans. And if I knew this could exist when I was starting out my career as a concert pianist, I would have totally gone this direction without a doubt. And then I have one, I guess every entrepreneur or creative has their like regrets on not taking initiative. Like I didn't take initiative on digital in 2015. I was super lazy about it.
Right.
And now that I look back, had I taken advantage of that, the pivot would have been a lot easier. Cause right now I'm still building the audience from scratch. Mm-hmm. And because I put so much of my career on building other businesses and building their social media presence and like building those business goals, like I now have to do that with myself, which is kind of weird, but also I know how expensive it is to grow an audience. So it's just like, oh man, if I capitalized the early wave in 2015, it'd be easier now. But like that's way in the past. So,
but that's a really interesting point for people who are watching this. You know, I mean, it's so easy for me to want to talk about this right now, because yesterday I recorded like a solo episode in between SOD to answer a question about what was hard for me as a content creator at the beginning. And one of which are some of the things that you reflected upon. I started the podcast in 2014. At that time, I was looking back to think, I wish I started doing this when I was 20. I mean, when I was in school, why did I wait until I'm like 31 years old or something? Like, this is ridiculous. And, but I'm really glad that at one point we started doing this. And if you're watching this thinking, I don't want to be judged, I don't feel like I have enough to offer to the world to build an audience, frankly, it's never too early to do this. And so, So what are your thoughts and learnings in terms of some of the things people don't know, right? Like it's expensive. You mentioned it's expensive to build an audience. What do you mean by that?
So like there's different ways to build it. Organic would be the dream scenario, which is what I'm doing right now. Everything I've done for music wise has been organic. So it's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And yeah, I don't have a blue check mark, but like I'm really proud of the following we have. Like, you know, we have a good group of fans who are really intellectual, who are funny and charismatic and thoughtful and really good listeners. So that's the best fan and artist can ask for, is like people who really care about what you're doing and what other people are doing.
And I'm going to clarify, sorry, George, I'm going to clarify a few things, which is you've started these live concerts on Instagram. That's one way that I've seen you being fairly active and consistent with building an audience. Is that accurate? Or were there other channels you're exploring too?
Yeah. So like on the organic side, the most expensive thing about organic is time. So like, I spent a lot of time doing Instagram live. Mm. In fact, my first album, Sonic Sanctum, I recorded that in one Instagram live session in one take. I remember, and the whole album's improvised. I remember putting it on. I think only three people tuned in who I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I just told those three people, I'm going to record a whole album in one take. And you three people are going to keep me accountable to finish it. Because as a classical musician, when we do recordings, if it's not 100% perfect, we freak out. So I had to like break that kind of horrible world of judgment. But anyways, aside from Instagram Live, a big driver has been Clubhouse. Like Clubhouse has been so amazing for my career. And it's starting to die down a little bit because the popularity is not as strong as it was a few months ago. But I'm indebted to that app. Like if we're using marketing terms.
This is great.
Like the lead generation from... like with the user funneling from Clubhouse to Instagram was incredibly successful. Like, but I never thought of it as a funnel until like the results were too obvious to ignore.
Tell us more. And
So like before the pandemic, I think I had like 600 Instagram followers.
Okay.
And now I have about 1900.
Okay.
And like, it doesn't sound like a lot, like compared to like, I don't know, Long probably has a couple million, but like that was all organic with no budget. Mm-hmm. Right? And like, and I believe I earned every follower. Like every follower is a human being that I think I've like seen somehow through Instagram or Clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And like I would open up a Clubhouse room. I would play piano for like 5 hours straight and I would be the host and I would take requests. Like people would request like, oh, I want Studio Ghibli, you know?
right now, Howl's Moving Castle. Or like Star Wars. Or Harry Potter. Or La La Land. And I would like improvise people's stories or moods and like.
Wait a minute. For anybody who's watching right now, if you guys have any song requests, please leave us a comment.
Yeah. And then like people would ask like, oh, do something in F minor. So I'd be like. So I would like improvise something in F minor and, and like, I would do that for 4 or 5 hours. And then after the session, I would get 40 more Instagram followers. And so that's like, you know, 10 an hour, which is like very, very bad. Like if you want to use like, yeah, Instagram terms, it's like, it's a very bad CTR or KPI, but like, but you know, I know it was bad, but like, I didn't pay a dime. And so that's why like, I worked really hard to get those 1900 people. And like, I wasn't thinking about the number, but like when I started seeing my Instagram grow, like I wasn't paying attention to Clubhouse. My Clubhouse was growing on its own. Right. And I was not paying attention to it. And then Instagram was growing. And then one of my friends DM'd me, he's like, dude, you just passed 1,000.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And I was like, I wasn't paying attention. And then after 1,000, I was like, oh shoot, this is like a real audience generation platform.
Wow.
I need to take advantage of it. So Clubhouse has been really great to me. And just like, I did a couple of brand collab concerts on the internet, like live stream, that has helped a little bit. Mm-hmm. I partnered with my old business partner at Giant Robot, who's actually more like my sensei. I really look up to him, and he gave me his Instagram to play music for the Giant Robot community every Sunday, and we've been doing that every week since the pandemic.
Even he's still doing now. It.
Yeah, wow. And so he has a pretty sizable audience, and like I've had so many crazy people have tuned in to that live session, like you know, like Tamlin Tomita, the actor. Kim Jong-gi, the artist, you know, like Johan from Linkin Park. Like, I've seen them like tune in. And it's surreal. Like, you know, I'm playing music for all these people. It's a really good feeling. Wow. So yeah, I think those were all the kind of different ways. I didn't do a paid ad. I've never, for my music, never did a paid media campaign. And I could have. Like, I know how to, there is a way to brute force it through paid media. Like, like whether it's Google ads or Facebook ads or Instagram ads, targeted ads, right? You create all these different A/B tests to test audience, demographic, behavior, interest, gender, you know, like location. Mm-hmm. And then you do 2 weeks of those tests, you do $100 per bucket, and then you take the highest performing one, then you change your budget to like $500 a day. And like, there's a very methodical way to do it, but I figured, now, if everything's truly organic and people follow me because they actually like the stuff, then like if there is money behind it, it will just be the greatest gasoline, right? Like then it will just take off. And so I feel like I don't really have a goal in terms of social media following, but like a good goal for this year would be like if I can get to 5,000 by the end of the year. And if I could on Spotify, if I can get to 3,000 followers, that would be very more than satisfied. And that's like for organic, that's a pretty difficult goal. But
hey, you know, I think, you know, I don't know how sophisticated everyone is when it comes to advertising promotion right now. So I'd love to see, you know, if you're watching this, like, did that make sense? Or can we elaborate a bit more on the definitions? But here's the thing, I think. Some of the takeaways, as George has learned in the past year, maybe year and a half, is that we are, you know, it's easy for us to want a blueprint to say that we want to go on certain platforms. Okay, that worked for Faye. Right. That worked really well for George. But realize we're telling these stories retrospectively. I know that for me, for instance, YouTube has worked out really well. I wish I got on YouTube when I started this podcast in 2014. I did not. I didn't start until late 2019. I'm like, damn, I just missed that boat. Like, you know, I missed the opportunity to start early. But for George, I mean, Clubhouse was great. For my colleague, Mike O'Brien, Clubhouse was great. So I think... Right. We have to, we owe that to ourselves to experiment. But secondly, I want to say is one thing I learned from Seth Godin, I learned a lot of things from him, but one thing I realized is you got to be careful when and how often you look at your stats, because sometimes they're not helpful. Because you look at, for me to look at YouTube, often I can think of, oh, I should really just produce more Zoom and virtual meeting videos. They always get picked up right away. I can see the trend. But the moment I talk about entrepreneurship, how to make money, or even YouTube growth, YouTube's like, no, that's not for you. You should do something else. Like, the algorithms can manipulate you as a content creator to do what they want. Oh, but I think... Right. Ultimately, like what we summarize here is that you have to know what you want and to be true to yourself. It's much easier said than done, for sure. So and actually, George, I would like to get a little practical here, that going on Clubhouse with as a musician is probably not the most trivial thing. So could you talk about your setup for Clubhouse? Because essentially it's the same for live stream. You're coming in really clear right now. Like, how are you able to do that? Where do you place your microphone? What is the microphone you're using at the moment?
Yeah, so I for this Zoom, I have two Neumann U87 AIs pointed at the piano that I got in the eighth grade because Guitar Center put the wrong price on them. And I actually saved up all my money to buy a guitar. And I went to Guitar Center, and you know, a Neumann U87 AI is almost $5,000 a piece. So that's $10,000 mic set. It's very expensive. But they put $2,000 for both.
Oh my goodness.
They like put the wrong price. And California state law, whatever price you advertise, you must sell. And so I just bought it. I walked home with no guitar. Mm-hmm. And I just bought these like really nice mics. And I had no audio interface. But I was like, I got it. And like, I've been using these mics ever since. But anyways, so yeah, I have that. And then I used to have it go through an iRig to my iPad, and it was like super sophisticated. But there's like this thing in design where it's the difference between a designer and an artist. An artist is striving for some kind of ideal thing. Mm-hmm. And a designer is striving for what works for a person. And so I did it. It's so much work to set up for Clubhouse with the iRig. Yeah. I did a fidelity test, because this is a handmade Steinway. You know, this piano was the piano they used in La La Land. So this is the piano Ryan Gosling played. And it's on loan from Steinway. So at Steinway and Sons, thank you for letting me borrow this
beautiful piano. Wait a minute. This is the actual piano, or just another model of what...
No, it's the...
This is love.
If you like listen to the recording, it sounds exactly the same. It's kind of creepy. So like they recorded on this piano, and they also used it and in the movie. And so like it's a beautiful piano in person. It's the best Model O, like a grand size, is like almost 6 feet. It's the best O I've ever played in my life. But through the iRig and my expensive mics, you can't really tell. And so like I would get feedback. People would think like, oh, what electric keyboard are you using? Because it's amazing. And I'm like,
oh no,
shit. This is a handmade Steinway built by 180 craftspeople. But like they just equated it to a Casio. And that sounded like, I was like, okay. And that kind of feedback let me do a test where I just use my iPhone mic. Yeah. And I had the same audience retention. So at that point, I was just like, screw setting everything up and spending 20 minutes just figuring out all this mic stuff and doing leveling. I just use my iPhone now, because the storytelling is more important than the fidelity. Like if you have something to say and it's potent, then who cares about the fidelity? And it makes me think about those horrible, horrible recordings that people got in the 50s and 60s of like bebop players, where they would drill a hole in the roof because they couldn't get into the gig, and they would drop the world's crappiest microphone to get a bootleg recording of the live performance. And the recordings were awful. But man, those records are legendary, like of Charlie Parker just going off and crazy, or Miles Davis when he was playing fast stuff, you know, like, and I thought it reminded me of that experience where people don't really care about fidelity if you have a really strong voice and it's meant to be heard. So I think like that was like the moment for me where I realized, yeah, I don't need a fancy setup. So for Clubhouse, I literally just use my iPhone. I don't hook it up to anything.
So that's a conclusion that a lot of people don't listen to, whether you're a meditation teacher or you're a singer, even, you know, you're a musician. And for me as a broadcaster, look, you don't need to fancy up the setup. And in retrospect, I mean, the lights, I didn't have an Elgato light. I did not have a, you know, 4K camera. And you start storytelling, especially at the beginning you're practicing. So with that said, I want to pull in one of the audience questions from Malcolm O'Brien. In regards to your music creation, do you have an aha moment that you pull inspiration from? Or do you say, I'm going to make some music now and have some deep thoughts on what I want to create? What are your thoughts?
That's a good question. I mean, inspiration comes from everywhere. I think I used to be a really big pre-planner. I used to think ahead all the time. Like, I'm going to be like, when I was in the business world, my goal was to become like Mark Zuckerberg. Like that was like my goal. That's stupid. Yeah, as a kid. But now with, I don't know what it is with this kind of music making, I'm now in the state of, I'm open to anything in the present. Like I have no thinking about the future. So I think that allows me to be inspired by many things at any given time. And songs come into my head randomly. Like I was talking to someone on Clubhouse and all of a sudden I was just like, while they were talking, I was muting my mic and just going like, I was just like, I doodle, like, you know how you doodle on a pen and paper? I doodle on the piano sometimes. So like, even when I'm talking, I can still play, but this is all subconscious playing. I'm not really thinking about what I'm doing. But then while I was doing that, I stumbled into, and I was like, oh crap, that's a song. Right? From talking to someone. Or like I had a dream, and in the dream I was on the piano. I, you know, because you never know when you enter and leave a dream, but like when I entered the dream, I was already at the piano and I was going, like I was like, oh, that's a song. Or sometimes there's artists that you love, and then you copy them, and then you form your own style. Like I love the way Hiromi Urahara plays Blackbird, and she does it her way, and then I came up with my version. Like instead of going, I would start with, and like I created my own version. So there's just endless ways to pull inspiration from. I will say though, the one that's more confined, like a designer, is film composing. Like when I write for film, like I'm working on a documentary right now. It's funny, like I composed most of the score, and like it wasn't right for the movie. The director was like, yeah, it doesn't work, and you have to like go back and redo it, but you get a bunch of feedback. And that kind of film composing reminds me of doing like agency design work. Right, like you have a wireframe, your client gives you feedback, you do an iteration of it, and then your client gives you feedback again, you redo it until you deliver the final version. And film composing, film scoring is very much like design iteration. So that one, you draw inspiration from the film, but the tunes that you come up with the movie, like this one movie I did for the Salt and Pepper biopic, like I knew it had to be like hip hoppy, and hip hop likes to do a lot of like. Hip-hop likes that chord progression a lot, and so I was just like watching the movie, and I was like, oh, what do I write as the main theme? And then I just thought of like, and that was just the main, that was the idea, and I was like, oh, that works. And like, it was like, it's uplifting enough but dramatic enough for all the elements, and then you can like change it, you can make it like sadder, you can go like, or you can make it uplifting, like you can go, you know, you can modify it really easily because it's so simple. And you know, that came from the movie subject, watching the movie, having inspiration from the genre. And then also from the practical standpoint as a film composer, like, what is that theme or motive that I can easily mold to be the thread for the entire movie? Because like, you'll notice movies you watch that have good music, there's a thread. And then movies you watch where you forget about the music, like the Avengers, like all of Marvel is like, aside from the Avengers theme song, and actually the music composed for the comic book flip in the beginning of the movie, it's not very memorable music.
Right.
It's not very like Star Wars. Yeah. So, anyways, yeah.
You've done a lot. I think I want to call out that maybe George Coe is not your household name. Maybe you haven't heard of George prior to this. And probably not. But I think what you're also hearing about is, number one, his parents probably very happy about paying all the tuition and fees for his early, I don't know, piano lessons. But number two is that you've really built a career in ways that you wanted. So could you speak to us a little bit about the career side of things? How are you able to now getting gigs to compose for movies? I also want to just maybe do a little bit brainstorm. There's so many podcasts out there, Livestream. Are you thinking about composing music for these new age creators as well? Like, how do you get these gigs?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Firstly, my parents are not thrilled that I did piano out of necessity. I hated piano. I hated, like, even in college, early parts of college, I wasn't like, I liked it kind of, like, you know, but I wasn't like, I'm gonna be a piano player. So my parents paid for it for utility, like help you get into college. Slash, my mom's dream was to be a concert pianist. So like, it was kind of like that Asian projection kind of mental health, bad for you thingy. I think my mom is proud of me. Mm-hmm. Which, like, you know, when an Asian parent says they're proud of you, it's like, oh, are you dying tomorrow?
No.
Like, is that why you're telling me? Like, no, it's like I've only heard my mom. My mom said that to me once my whole life. I've never heard it from my dad. And I know my dad's not thrilled I'm a musician, but whatever, it's fine. But I think, like, in terms of the career, like, how am I getting these opportunities? To be honest, I used to approach career like a type A Ivy League business-minded person. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd be super aggressive and, like I would get the sale, you know? Because that was the way I was taught from my father, because he's an entrepreneur and he was an immigrant and he was heavily discriminated against. And I was discriminated against in corporate, not like him, but like, cause that was the 70s. But, I faced a lot of racism, ageism, in corporate and in the tech world. And, so I was very aggressive, but I realized, you know, going through therapy and continuing to go to therapy, that I'm a type B personality. My natural inclination is not to be aggressive and to be confrontational and unpleasant and disagreeable. And so I don't know. I used to be like really gung-ho and aggressive and ask people for things up front. And like, if you read the 48 Laws of Power or Machiavelli's print, The Prince, you think that's the way to do it. But honestly, with music now, I'm just in a state of, I'm friends with everyone I work with. And all these amazing opportunities have been given to me. I didn't even ask for the film composing stuff. A friend who I took headshots for when I was shooting photography professionally called me one day and was just like, hey, I remember you played the piano. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, I used to. And they're like, I got a movie I'm working on. Can I like talk to you about it? So we just got coffee and hung out. And that friend is Dan Nakamura. He's known as his producer name is Dan the Automator. And he produced like the Gorillaz. And like, so he's like a big hip hop producer. And I'm just like this rando piano player. And we worked on this movie together during the pandemic. And we had a great time. Like during the pandemic, we quarantined for like 20 days each. And I went to his house in the Bay Area and we recorded this like synth electric, the synth piano, like synth orchestral album for fun. Like we never released it, but it was like just fun, you know? And I think like, once I entered the state of like, I'm just going to have fun with my friends.
Right.
And I think if I'm a good person and I'm kind and I surround myself with people who have similar values and, but I still work really hard and I know I'm good at what I do, I think the good things will come. And that this way of building the career has been way more enjoyable than like, when I was going for like $20 million evaluations for a startup, right? Like I, like people are like, oh, like who, you know, who did you, which tree did you climb to get the gig? And I said, literally none of them. Like it was falling into my hand. I'm just super grateful.
And that's, so,
yeah.
I'm so glad you touch upon that. I mean, there's, you know, I feel like there's something that to be said. I mean, we just passed the month of June, again, Asian American, Pacific Islander celebration. But, you know, I'm so thrilled, number one, that we're able to acknowledge and address and openly talk about mental health. Yesterday, I was recording an episode for the other podcast I'm managing right now called Enabled Disabled. And the host and I started an interview to talk about the progress behind the scenes. And I was very open about mental health. And especially for us growing up, I'm sort of like first generation. I think in a way, like it's so weird. They combine, like if your parents are first generation, you can be considered as first or second generation, but I'm certainly first gen. And there is an enormous amount of pressure that comes with it. So I'm really glad. And I'm even happier for the fact that you've chosen a path where you can actually be you and not worry about the analytics, the likes, the comments, the shares, but doing something you love and attract people who come to you for you and for your, by the way, as a content creator, it's not just the music you produce, but the way you work with them, the process and right. Like it's so interesting. So I know that we're running a little bit out of time. What are some of the things that you really want to share, but I haven't asked or haven't really gotten to?
No, I would say though, if you're going to pursue an artistic endeavor, do it wisely. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not making that much money right now. I'm going to be totally honest. This piano on loan from Steinway, you know, like all the equipment I have has been with me for the last decade of collecting and saving. Mm-hmm. And I'm living off of my savings right now. You know, I saved aggressively in my mid-20s. And so, you know, I can ride out till next year. Mm-hmm. And so like, I didn't take the plunge just willy-nilly without planning. Like I worked a day job. I was a director at Caltech. I guess I want to brag a little bit. I'm the first Asian American male director in Caltech history. So
What kind of director? I mean, music?
I was a very, you know, typical, it was a very corporate higher ed job. Director of strategic partnerships at the Alumni Association.
Gotcha.
And Yeah, I quit. I quit in four. I was the fastest quitting Caltech employee of all time, too. I quit in 4 months. but like, you know, I took day jobs. I did consulting gigs. I saved a lot. And that's why I can do what I want to do now. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is you have to have tools. Like if you're going to pursue music full time, you have to be good. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why I can do film composing is, yeah, I could sit down in one day and write a whole movie. But that's because of, I mean, like, I remember at Harvard, the first week of class, you know, our teacher played a recording of a Bach Prelude and Fugue. Oh, I don't remember. Let's see. I don't remember it. But anyways, he played this recording of this Bach Prelude and Fugue, and then he's like, notate it. That was the first, that was the intro to theory class. And it was so intense. And I did not do well academically at Harvard, but I remember studying so hard. And like, we had to write Mozart sonatas, you know, we had to write like Chopin nocturnes and etudes mm-hmm. as like undergrads without a master's degree. But that training is so invaluable because now I work incredibly fast, you know, and then the years of classical playing, when I play more modern stuff, like I can play A major scale at the concert level without thinking because I did so much practice. Or like I can play like a Chopin etude. Not totally accurately, but like I can still play without like really practicing. But that's not because I'm a prodigy. It's because mm-hmm. you know, I've been working on this stuff for a really long time. So I think that's mm-hmm. the number one advice I have for young people who want to pursue the arts is if you want to do it full time, you have to be good at it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the best at it because that's impossible. Mm-hmm. But you have to be really good at it. You have to be proficient. Mm-hmm. You have to have the money saved up. If you don't have the money saved up, there's nothing wrong with taking a day job and side hustling. Yeah. You're going to have to make some sacrifices. Like maybe you can't really go on dates all the time or you're going to have to explain your significant other like, hey, I know we were planning to like da 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 da, but like maybe we'll like, I need to like practice. Like there's going to be those tough conversations if that's a goal you want to pursue. Mm. So be prepared for that. Don't have lofty expectations.
Right.
Mm. Really live in the present. Really like focus on what you're working on at the moment. Be kind to everyone because you never know. Like I just got a gig in October from a family friend I've known since I was 6 years old. And she's never offered this gig to me. Mm. And so like, you never know. And I'm so incredibly grateful to her. And so like, you never know where these opportunities are going to come from. So always be kind to people, you know, I mean, I could have like my checklist would just be like practice, like be good at what you do, be kind to people, live in the present, lower your expectations so you don't get disappointed, take care of your mental health, because if you're mentally unstable, even a little bit, it will come through your art, it will come through your work and your relationships with people, get paid. Don't be a freelancer in the sense of getting things done for free. Get paid, even if it's $5. Like design work. I charge, like when I do brand consulting, if I'm doing a whole brand identity with like brand values and everything, and you come out with a brand guideline, my rate is $50,000. That's my personal rate. And I don't change it. And people are like, well, that's too expensive. And I say, okay, go to an agency. They're going to charge you $500,000. We're going to do the same work, but that's why I'm worth $50,000 just for one person. Cause I will do what the agency does, but it's just me. And I do it five times faster. But like the reason why I can charge that as an individual is cause I have all this experience. And so like, don't devalue work, get paid. And be an entrepreneur, learn everything. Just because you're an artist doesn't give you permission to not be a booking manager or learn about how to do public speaking, or learn about how to build your own website, how to build your own social following, learning about photography. Like, you should be open. Like, I will never forget what Yo-Yo Ma said to me. Yo-Yo, we were doing a masterclass, and Yo-Yo said, like someone asked Yo-Yo, do you think anything's boring? And he said, if you genuinely believe in the creative process and the joy it brings humanity, there's no way you can find anything boring. The boringness comes from the lack of good delivery. But the subject, no subject in the world is boring. And it's like that idea of tapping into that present moment fluidity of exploration. And so, like, always be in that state as much as you can. And also, it's okay to sometimes not do anything. Like, I used to be so busy, and I had to always be super productive. I planned, like, in college, I had my days planned from 5 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day. And I even planned my sleeping time, how much lunch I could have, and all that bullshit. And I realized, like, oh, what an idiot. And, like, even now, I don't have that schedule anymore, and I'm way more productive.
Yeah.
In the long run. So, anyways, that's my little ramble on that.
No, I love the final, so I guess, like, a rapid fire summaries of things that you learned. Another, I would say, a call to action for people thinking about pivoting their careers. I think what George just mentioned is, if you have a specific skill, you come from a, you know, corporation. Like, for me, that was project management. I was known for that. I knew I could demand a lot more for that. So I would use my skill A to get paid, like George did with design work. And then I will basically use that budget to fuel into my creative endeavors. That was really, really important. So that is something to know. And then I think the final thing was also you need a buffer. You need space in your life in general. That also applies to moms, caregivers out there. You need space to think independently, to think comfortably when our lives are just too packed. And some of that is, it is a little superficial too. You look at your schedules, like, do I really need to be this busy? Do I have to say yes to everything? Right. Like, I totally agree with you. I feel like I'm operating on a different level as a result of creating space and buffer in my schedule and not thrive or brag about how busy I am all the time.
Yeah. So, people who brag about how busy they are, like, now I look at them, I'm like, that is not something to brag about, man. Like, that just sounds miserable. Oh, I will say one piece of advice if you're Asian American, because I can say this because I'm Asian American.
Because we are. Yeah.
I don't know if we're allowed to swear on this show, so I think I did it a couple times, so I apologize.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah.
So I would just say, move the fuck out. Like, don't live at home. And I'm not saying that, like, okay. Like, if you were not super, if you came from a non-immigrant family scenario, like, maybe you could live at home. The reason why I say that is because for 6,000 years of East Asian history, speaking up and having your own voice never existed. Okay. This idea of taking care of your mental health and well-being has never existed in pious culture, feudalist culture. This is the biggest, it's not just a culture shock. It's a complete, like, generational, ideological, spiritual shock to your parents. Yeah. So if you're stuck at home and you went to an Ivy League or you went to a great school, like you went to Purdue or UCLA or whatever, and you go home, you quit your day job as an engineer, and now you're going to be a chef. In their heads, you're just a piece of shit. Like, they're going to remind you every day you live at home. And then you're going to get angry. You're going to hate your parents. You're going to think they're the worst humans in the world. It's going to tear. And, like, you'll end up, like, every great Asian creative that we look up to, or every minority creative who came from an immigrant family in America, at least, not, almost all of them have terrible relationships with their parents. It's because of that. And so, like, my biggest advice is, find a way to move the fuck out, because the moment you leave the home and there is that physical barrier, and, you know, Asian parents are like, well, I haven't seen you in 2 weeks. You don't love me anymore. No, that's not true. I just don't want to see you because you're crazy. And, like, but then when you create the distance, you'll do miracles. You have, like what you're talking about, Faye, like, you have your space. They will respect you a lot more because Asian people love money. And if you're not spending your parents' money, that just demands respect. So I would say even like specifically for people in immigrant families in the United States, if you're going to be an artist,
yeah,
you have to save up even more money to live on your own.
Oh, amen.
Like I will say, if I didn't leave my parents' place, like I would not be doing the music I do now, because mm-hmm. like they would be like, oh, you're not playing classical. Even when I was playing classical, like this is how mm-hmm. tough it is to be in a household like that. Like even when I was playing classical and I was like selling out concerts around the world, they mm-hmm. would still criticize my playing. And like, do they have any basis of telling me how to play Rachmaninoff? No, but they think they do because they put the food on the table. But the moment you take that power away, mm. what are they going to say? And the only thing that's left is unspoken respect. So yeah. that's another thing I would add to the list is if you're an immigrant, kid of an immigrant, or you're Asian, yeah, move the fuck out. That's
no, I love, I mean, that's a transparency. I mean, yeah. right? Like people don't hear about that. And I'm really glad you brought it up. Yeah. And it's very different now. I'm in a, you know, I lived away from my parents since I was 17, 16 years old. I mean, literally yeah. 8,000 miles away. But now I bought a house and it happened to be a big house where I invite my mom in. She tells me how proud she is of me every single day. I take care of her. She gets to do her artwork. Thank you. But frankly, this relationship that I'm witnessing with my mom, sorry, I don't know. I can't tell you there's a second relationship like that. And right? You have yeah. to choose the right people. The same thing, like you can't choose your family, you choose your friends. But if your family doesn't understand what you're doing, you know, podcasting being one of them, it doesn't matter if you're Asian or not Asian, people tend to ask you during family get-togethers, like how much oh, are yeah. you getting paid? How much money are you getting
what's
paid?
What's that fun thing you were doing again? Like I'll Bobby. Never forget. I played piano one time for the now president, Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was sharing with the Asian aunties, like, I got to play for the vice president. You know, yeah. I played, what did I play for Joe? Uncle Joe. I played the third ballad. And he likes Chopin. So I played the third ballad. And I'm like, you know, like, what an honor, right? And the first thing those aunties asked was, did you get paid?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, that's what you got from that? I just played for the second most powerful human being in the entire free world and like one of the most beloved politicians and yeah. and the guy who's been fighting for civil rights and mm-hmm. all these like things since he was 30, like one of the youngest Congress person in American history. And you asked me if I got paid, and it's mm-hmm. the whole value system is yeah. just not like, I'll never forget when I even got into Harvard, I thought like that's the Asian mm-hmm. dream, right?
Right.
And then I have my dad tell me like, you know, going to Harvard doesn't mean anything if you can't make money. And I was just yeah. like, whoa, you know, that yeah. Chinese word fool, like that word fool has fucked up like all of Chinese thinking. Cause like fool is not really like truly like fruitfulness, like the way America, like, you know, we have translated fool. Fool mm-hmm. has the word money in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about money. It's not about like values and ethics and like bound, like all these like lofty things that we've like put in like anime or like Avatar the Last Airbender. It's more like it's actually like money.
I mean, it's fool, you know, is it's money. You know, not every single family is, you know, not every single family is like that. I've known poor families who, you know, don't even think about money all that much and trying to support one another. But it's true. I think whenever it comes to money, same thing with analytics, likes and followings, there's a single number you can yeah. look at and measure people and put people in boxes. Yeah. But, you know, I think another key takeaway, like George said, is you got to find your own friends, got to find like-minded people who that really jive with you, that you can do work with, collaboration, yeah. speaking of which, right? That's why we're here. And I would encourage anybody, it doesn't matter how small your platform is, trying to not just promote, the word is promote, but celebrate other people's work and, you know, put them, if you're a YouTuber or a podcaster, you know, you're naturally can invite other people to join you in and to give people an opportunity to talk about their stories, their backgrounds. So I'm so grateful, George. I know you and I can talk about this forever. and I appreciate the transparency. And hopefully you'll come back and join me again.
No, yeah, it'd be an honor. Hopefully we could do one in person, you know.
Yeah.
That would be fun, and it'd be cool to do one with a piano in person. And no, thank you, Faye, for always thank you for the opportunity, but more importantly, it's just great to catch up. And wish you the best. Wish you and your audience the best. And if you are not already subscribed to any of Faye's channels, please give her a follow on LinkedIn, YouTube, and all her socials. Don't forget to visit her website or just Google Faye's World Media. This show is not, I don't know if there is a sponsor, but if there isn't, if there is a sponsor that would like to sponsor Faye, please give Faye a follow and contact her business email. I think.
Thank you for the outro. I didn't even do anything. Oh, thank you, George. Okay, I'm going to take offline, take us offline, and see you guys. Check out my calendar, faceworld.com/events. You're going to find out all the independent artists, content creators, creative entrepreneurs joining me in the upcoming month. And ending stream now. Bye.